It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A federal appeals court ruled that Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. We're taking your comments right now over at the Central Time Facebook page.
First, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has updated their fishing and fish consumption guidelines for Wisconsin.
While there are many health benefits to eating freshly caught fish, they can take in pollutants from the water they live in, the food they eat, meaning fish consumption can pose health risks to humans. That's where these annual guidelines come in.
Here to talk about the latest fish consumption advice is Candy Schrank. She's an environmental toxicologist with the Fisheries Management Program at the Wisconsin DNR. Candy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So why do we need to be careful about eating the fish we're catching out of Wisconsin's lakes and rivers?
We know that from our testing since the 1970s that some fish contain higher levels of mercury, PCBs, and other pollutants, where we want people to follow our consumption advisory so that their health, you know, remains in good shape.
Now, there are a lot of lakes and rivers in Wisconsin. Have they all been tested?
No. Wisconsin DNR has a testing program where we try to get to a number of lakes, and we also repeatedly sample some water bodies like Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, and so forth. But we have tested about 2,000 water bodies out of, you know, all the various numbers of lakes and rivers in Wisconsin. And for the most part, people can follow our statewide general advisory that applies to all inland waters. And the consumption advice ranges from one meal a week to do not eat. So if people are eating fish from Wisconsin waters, we just ask that they think about, you know, how often they eat fish. Most people don't eat a lot of fish, but if they're frequent fish eaters, we would like them to go to our webpage and look at our fish consumption advisories.
Now, it seems that there is sort of a good news, bad news scenario going on with these new guidelines versus Great Lakes fish and then some inland lake fish. What have you found?
Well, each year we test a number of different water bodies, you know, and every year we update the advice. So our information focuses on the water bodies where our advisory changed. But in some cases, you know, the information that we gathered results in no change. So in a way, that no change in advice is also news. For instance, we did sample or obtain new data for 28 inland waters where the consumption advisories did not change, and they remain under the general advisory. But we did remove some exceptions to our general advisory for Sugar Camp chain, and we did add some slightly more stringent advisories for a few of our northern lakes. And that's with regard to mercury, where mercury tends to accumulate in fish to higher levels in the northern lakes.
Now, reading your fish-eating consumption guidelines online, it seems as though with PCBs, there are some of the PCBs that will melt away with the fat if you grill it on a rack. Is there any such preparation method with mercury that can lessen the impact?
For mercury, what we recommend is that people choose smaller sizes of fish and also just, you know, look for like panfish or try to fish a different lake compared to a lake that might have a more stringent advisory. And there's only 145 water bodies that have these more stringent advisories. So there's a lot of different waters where people can go and catch a fish and take it home and eat it. So, you know, the cooking and cleaning is still, or the trimming of the fish is still a good idea to reduce any sort of contaminants that might be in the fat. But in addition, if they, like you said, grill it and let the fat drip away, that will reduce the PCB burden in the fillet.
Now, in terms of trout, there's a bit of good news there. It seems like that's gotten a little bit safer to eat from the Great Lakes anyway.
Well, we've been, like I said, we've been updating our advice every year, and we resample fish from Lake Michigan and Lake Superior every other year. So this year we did relax the advisory for brown trout to one meal a month, and in Green Bay we relaxed the advisory for Chinook to 1 meal a month also. And we have found that looking at PCB levels in salmon, that PCB levels have declined over the period of, 1975 to about 2010 in looking at that data more in depth.
Now, you've said these guidelines have been relaxed on trout to 1 meal a month. That's not a lot of fish, Wisconsin fish, eaten a month. So does that tell us we should be kind of alarmed at the state of Wisconsin's waters?
Well, all states and, even if, go to Canada, there's consumption advisories. 1 meal a month is, for brown trout and, if you think about all the other fish that you can eat, there's a lot of different species that are available that people can eat more frequently. Panfish, the rainbow trout, and there's, a good variety, a diversity of species that people can fish. And if you, if people want to go online to our webpage at dnr.wi.gov and just search for Eating Your Catch, we also have a cookbook where a variety of fish species are highlighted and show different recipes and also the cooking and cleaning methods so that, people do have a choice in what fish they take home to consume.
Well, you mentioned one or two, but if there are, say, three fish in Wisconsin lakes that we can eat, what are they?
If there are three fish in Wisconsin lakes, well, again, panfish are a good choice, like crappie, yellow perch, bluegill, salmon or trout, inland trout are an excellent choice to select.
All right, gotcha. And we'll leave it there. Candy,
okay.
Thank you for the suggestions, and thank you for talking today.
All right, thank you.
That was Candy Schrank. She's an environmental toxicologist with the Fisheries Management Program at the Wisconsin DNR. This year brings the 100th anniversary of the birth of a Wisconsin entertainment phenomenon whose shows have been seen by 50 million people around the world. Anyone who's gone to the Wisconsin Dells or just put on a pair of water skis knows the name Tommy Bartlett.
The Tommy Bartlett Thrill Show and Tommy Bartlett Exploratory are major attractions in the Dells. Their owner, Tom Deal, knew Tommy Bartlett well. He's with us to talk about Bartlett's life and work. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
It's my pleasure, Rob. Look forward to talking with you.
Well, how did you first meet Tommy Bartlett?
It's very interesting. I was doing my undergraduate education at Cornell University in the School of Hotel Administration. And my wife, or my future wife and I, had decided that we were going to get married at the end of my junior year. And I went into the placement office looking for husband and wife job for the summer of 1967. Normally those jobs were in the Adirondack Mountains, the Poconos, the Catskills, the Cape, somewhere, in the eastern part of the country where those resorts needed help in the summertime. So I went into the placement office on Monday, and Tommy Bartlett shows up on Tuesday morning looking for a husband and wife team to help in Wisconsin Dells. He had purchased a motel and a restaurant to secure the site for his water ski show. And he happened to be in emceeing the Boston Sports Show, and Joe Namath was the celeb for the 10-day show. He was the number one draft choice out of Alabama to play for the Jets. And so Tommy and Joe befriended each other during that 10 days, and of course Tommy was bemoaning the fact that he had this wonderful attraction, but he was losing money at this motel and restaurant and the concessions. And so Namath, being from western Pennsylvania, said, why don't you stop at Cornell on your way back to Wisconsin Dells and see if you can find somebody. So he appears on Tuesday. I interview with him. Yeah, he hires me. At that juncture, I barely knew where Wisconsin was, nonetheless, Wisconsin Dells. So that's how it all got started.
And you're still there. Now, how did Tommy Bartlett first get into the idea of putting on these ski shows on the water?
Well, as you're aware, Tommy was a famous radio and TV star. He started his career in Milwaukee at 13 years old, working for WISN Radio. And then when he turned 18, he went to Chicago and worked his way up. He was staff announcer for WBBM, I know, and ended up having his own radio shows, Meet the Misses and the early Welcome Travelers show. Tommy was one of the very few radio personalities who made the transition from radio to TV. And, of course, started and had a 9-year run on the Welcome Travelers show in Chicago. And he was asked to MC the Railroad Fair show in Chicago down by Navy Pier. And that was in 1948 or 49. I don't remember the exact year. And as a part of that show, Dick Pope, who owns Cypress Gardens, brought a water skiing team up there, and they performed during the railroad fair. Tommy, being a tremendous entertainer, thought, boy, I'll tell you, there's some tremendous entertainment value with this water skiing, and this might be a good hedge against the Nielsen rating, but sooner or later, you know, my days in TV are going to be over with. So he took it upon himself to go up to Fond du Lac and meet with Carl Kiekhaefer, who founded Mercury, Mercury Marine, and basically said to Carl, I'm a radio and TV star. I'm a promoter. I will assemble a water ski troupe. You put up the boats and the motors and all the rest of the stuff, and we will tour all of North America, and we will take water skiing to the masses. And the more people get interested in water skiing, the more boats and motors you're going to sell.
Wow.
And that started a relationship in 1949 that we still have with Mercury. Here we are in 2014. And so Tommy at one time had three or four troops out touring through North America, and including Canada, and Tommy would do the advance with the radio stations at the local communities, promoting the fact that the Tommy Bartlett water ski show was going to be taking place at whatever lake or river that they were doing it, and he would do the advance, and then they would come in, perform the show, and go to the next town. So in 1952, they stopped in the Madison Edgewater Hotel on Lake Mendota in Madison, and they put on a show there, and then the next day, that was on a Saturday, and the next day they were scheduled to do a show in the Upper Dells in Wisconsin, downtown Wisconsin Dells. Well, the local business community leaders were so enthralled with the quality of the show, and more importantly, Tommy's tremendous name recognition in the Chicago market, said, gee, if we could convince this guy to bring his show here permanently, we will have won the PR battle, because his name recognition was higher than the Dells. So in 1953, they had found a location where we are right now, and in 53, Tommy opened the very first summer here, with the Tommy Bartlett water ski show, and here we are, 62 years later, and we're still here. And it's a real tribute to Tommy that this has stood the test of time.
Well, as you mentioned, he helped put water skiing on the map. Did he really help put Wisconsin Dells on the map as the synonym for tourism in Wisconsin?
There's no question about it that, and I think when the Visitor and Convention Bureau honored Tommy as their second member, Jack Olson was the first, and Tommy was the second, and they refer to him as Mr. Wisconsin Dells because Tommy put Wisconsin Dells on the map as a viable tourism destination, centrally located between the Chicago and Minneapolis markets. So people here credit Tommy with creating the Dells that we have today.
Now, what was it about him as a promoter and an entrepreneur that made him so successful at establishing first the water ski show and then other elements of his empire in the Dells area?
Well, it's really interesting, by today's standards, entertainers are not promoters. If an entertainer has a good idea, or if the radio, TV, or basically TV wants to put together a show, it's not like it was back in the 50s. I remember Tommy telling me that when he created Welcome Travelers, he had to go and find sponsors for his own show. The network had nothing to do with it. You had to do it yourself. And he said, I traveled to Cincinnati at least 16 times trying to convince Procter & Gamble to sponsor the Welcome Traveler show. And he said, I really think they got so sick of seeing this redhead, pimply-faced kid come to the office that they finally agreed to do it. And, of course, Procter & Gamble sponsored his TV show for the entire time that it ran, the nine-year term.
What was he like to work with as a personality?
Well, it's interesting. I spent all those years with Tommy, and it was a great relationship because Tommy was a showman and a promoter, and my background was basically more in the business side of it. And so Tommy taught me the entertainment side and taught me the marketing and promotion side of it, which has allowed me to continue in the capacity that I have been in since his death in 1998. He was a great teacher, I'd like to believe that he instilled in me the same sense of value and showmanship that he had. I mean, I can't tell you the number of shows that I sat with him and watching, and he would make notes on how to make the show even better. He would say, we're at 98%, but we have got to get to 200%. And in his philosophy, he said, I don't care if there's one person in the audience who is blind and has a seeing eye dog with them, we are going to have the best possible show in the world. It makes no difference whether there's one person here or there are 5,000 people here. We're going to do the same quality show. And his showmanship was just unbelievable. And, you know, teaching these young skiers who were excellent at what they did, but they, you know, how to smile, how to style, how to present themselves, which is an overall, you know, part of the experience that we try to give people here.
Do you still feel that pressure? You know, our show was at 98% last week. How do we bring it up to 100% this week?
Trust me, I spend, we have 201 shows a summer. I probably watch 190 of them, constantly trying to make sure that our kids understand the importance of the showmanship and the quality of what we're giving. Because Tommy always said that that we want to give people something that they can't turn their TV on and watch, and we always want to make sure that we give more value than what we're charging for their ticket price.
I got to ask, he was big in putting water skiing on the map, water skiing performance. I believe he's in a water ski hall of fame. Did Tommy Bartlett water ski himself?
He did it one time.
One time.
And it was on his 70th birthday. And I said to him, you're the greatest showman in the world that I know of, and you're the P.T. Barnum promoter of the world, and what better way of getting PR for the show than to have Tommy Bartlett ski on his 70th birthday? And he agreed to it, and we had a specially designed wetsuit made for him, and we had skis made for him where the ropes were attached to the tips of the ski, and then he was holding on to ropes from the ski going up. And we got him up when it was going to happen on the night show of his birthday. We got him up on the cove, and the person who helped get him up dropped off. And Tommy came skiing by the office, or by the audience, let go with one hand, gave the big wave and the big smile, and skied to the dock and let go. And that was his one and only time of skiing.
And he hit the marks on his smile and his style?
We have the picture that we have on a big vinyl that we have in our trail, which has a lot of the old time, the USO shows and some of the history of the show, and that one is a hit. I mean, it's he's got that big grin on his face, and he was a showman for that day.
Tom, thank you so much for sharing his story with us.
You have a nice day.
That was Tom Deal, owner of Tommy Bartlett's Thrill Show and Tommy Bartlett Exploratory, with us to talk about the life of Wisconsin legend Tommy Bartlett. Some breaking news this afternoon. After hearing oral arguments just over a week ago, a federal appeals court has ruled that same-sex marriage bans in both Wisconsin and Indiana are unconstitutional. Here now to bring us the latest on the story is Sean Johnson, our state government reporter here at WPR. Sean, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, you were with us just over a week ago talking about what happened during the oral arguments. You pointed out the judges seemed, especially Richard Posner, were incredibly skeptical of the state's defenses that the argument for traditional marriage didn't hold water. So the decision, maybe not a surprising one, but are you surprised at how fast it came down?
It did come fast, and as it turns out, you know, Judge Posner, he was not just playing devil's advocate in those oral arguments. He was very sharply attacking the rationale, or as he saw it, the lack of rationale for gay marriage bans in Wisconsin and Indiana, really pressuring lawyers for both states to give reasons as to why those bans exist and who's being harmed by allowing gay marriage in either state. He said they weren't, that he wasn't hearing any rationale for them. And he said as much in his opinion today. He said that when there's no justification for governments treating a traditionally discriminated against group significantly worse than the dominant group in society, doing so denies equal protection of the laws. And he said that, the rationale that was given for these bans by Wisconsin and Indiana, quote, is so full of holes that it cannot be taken seriously. Hmm. So a very strong opinion, very lengthy opinion, and it's something you would presume that maybe he wrote ahead of time a bit, but he references oral arguments extensively in this. So this is everybody talks about Judge Posner being quite the writer. He's written several books. He churned this opinion out, and very much the judge that you heard in oral arguments is reflected in the opinion.
And as I understand it, the argument made the case that it was a pro-family decision to strike down the same-sex marriage ban.
And Posner, in his decision here, says, ostensibly this ban is here to help families, but essentially what you're doing is you're hurting gay couples who want to have children. Especially in a state like Wisconsin, you could one parent could be an official parent of a kid in a same-sex couple. The other can't. They want to adopt, but they can't. And he said in oral arguments that in no uncertain terms, he thought the kids would be better off if they had two parents, especially two parents who wanted to have kids. And that's a point that he makes in his opinion. There's been one of the arguments that the state has made in favor of the gay marriage ban is that this is something that was enacted by a majority of Wisconsin voters in 2006, that is the will of the people. And that's something that, I haven't had a chance to read the Posner opinion completely at this point, but he said, he kind of made short work of that. He said, quote, minorities trampled on by the democratic process have recourse to the courts. The recourse is called constitutional law. So in other words, the Constitution is there to protect people who are hurt by the majority. And that's what Posner is saying the court's doing in this case.
Well, we'll be digesting this decision over the next few days, but a couple questions that loom large now. Are people going to be running to the county clerk's office like they did last time around to get marriage licenses? Can they do that based on where we are now?
I don't think so right now. I think that both sides are in agreement right now that can't happen. The Department of Justice certainly said so, that the stay that was issued by the district court, which essentially keeps the gay marriage ban intact while this lawsuit is being appealed. Department of Justice said that stay is still in effect, and the State Department of Justice, spokeswoman for Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen, said Van Hollen always expected this would be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, which is where they're going to appeal it next. The ACLU, which represented the plaintiffs in this case, said that certainly you're not going to see marriage for the next 21 days. In 21 days, they said that the Seventh Circuit Court would issue its mandate in this case, and so you get into the nuts and bolts of what's going to happen here in a way that I'm not necessarily completely familiar. But you know, once that mandate comes down, there would be opportunities for the Seventh Circuit to stay its own ruling, or potentially the U.S. Supreme Court could stay the ruling as it did in another circuit, you know, Court of Appeals. I think the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals. But, you know, at least in the short term, the next few weeks, there will not be same-sex marriage allowed in Wisconsin.
And ultimately, probably ends up in the Supreme Court.
With many other similar cases that are progressing throughout the country, yes.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Yep, thank you.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR State Government Reporter. These days, if you want to contribute to a discussion online, there's a chance the site or the forum you're using is going to want a key piece of information, your real name. That's a change from the way the internet used to be, when users could remain relatively anonymous just about everywhere on just about anything.
There are various reasons for the push for real names. Some say it improves civility and holds people accountable for their words. But our next guest says we're losing something if we don't let people find themselves in the relatively safe space of an anonymous internet.
Joining us now is Lydia Lawrenson. She's a writer, researcher, and media strategist based in San Francisco. Her piece, A More Pseudonymous Internet, appeared in The Atlantic. Lydia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. How are you guys doing?
Well, really good. So in this piece you wrote, really interesting, you tell a story about an anonymous man who ran what was then called the Goldman Sachs Elevator Gossip Twitter account. Can you tell us the story and how it got you thinking about our identity on the internet?
Sure. Well, there's a bunch of things wrapped up in this. The GS Elevator account is a really interesting example because that's someone who wouldn't have done what he did if he hadn't had access to anonymity. And he's just a guy. He's just a banker who saw that there was a lot of funny stuff coming out of Goldman Sachs and the banking industry in general. And so he started this Twitter account where he would tweet, like, real quotes that he'd heard or that his friends had heard or that people wrote into the account. And a lot of them were in really bad taste and really, like, revealed some of the, like, horrors of Wall Street in a certain way. You know, like people saying like really like awful things about women or like, you know, awful things about people who make less than $500,000 a year or whatever. And he definitely, I mean, again, he got revealed in the end and he was okay with that, but he would never have started if he hadn't had anonymity in the beginning. And that's a really good example of someone who was kind of experimenting and playing around and ended up doing something important in that safe space of anonymity. And he has been used as kind of like a banner in a lot of different ways. Like, he actually has a lot of fans who are bankers who, like, for whatever reason, look at his account and are like, wow, that makes me want to be an investment banker, which is kind of funny, I guess. I mean, it's not a reaction that I would have. But he's also been used as, like, an example of what banking culture is and kind of a cautionary tale and a banner for, like, the 99% and all those kinds of movements.
Well, it seems as though the movement to make people use their real names or some form of their real identity online has been to stop bullying, to stop the trolls who are using profanity and saying threatening things. So that's the one side. Why do you think we should make the case that being anonymous on the internet actually outweighs that concern?
Well, the first thing to say is that, honestly, that's a very bad argument because it doesn't work that way. There are cases where forcing real name usage can decrease bullying or whatever other negative social effect you want to name. But for the most part, when you have systems like that in place for a long time, the behavior comes back to the same level that it was at pre-anonymity, right? So the plain fact is people are mean to other people. People will be mean on the internet, even if they are using their real names. That's going to happen. And we know this. This isn't a matter of opinion because there are countries and environments that have forced real name usage, and they've found that after a while, it comes back to the same level. You can find articles like that. I linked one in my article in The Atlantic, or if you just search for, like, TechCrunch real names, TechCrunch ran an article about this a while back. So there's that, you know.
Well,
but even if you were to say that it was important for whatever reason, anti-bullying, accountability, whatever reason you want to name. I think the main thing is just allowing people to experience that elastic space and learn about themselves as people more in anonymity is an extremely valuable thing. It has a lot to do with how people experience themselves as human beings and how people, you know, accomplish important things in the world.
Well,
it's
you write that
experimental space because people can try different things that they wouldn't be able to try otherwise. And it's a personal space where people can learn things that they might not have had the opportunity to learn otherwise.
Well, yeah, you write that in the early days of the internet, and in your early days of the internet, it was an opportunity to anonymously try on different identities, to behave in different ways, to kind of figure out who you are or who you could be.
Right, exactly. And, you know, an important point that has been made by me and also by anthropologists and people who study the internet in different contexts is that these aren't pointless things that you're learning. You know, it's not like you go on the internet and you do something and you forget it, you never, like, think about it again. The internet is real. It's real experience. So if you go online and you manage to make an identity that is, say, like, an incredible leader in a game, right, you are learning real leadership skills that you can then apply in other environments. And so there's been a lot of anthropologists and a lot of writers who have pointed out that people go on the internet and they learn how to be community organizers. They learn how to build bridges. Like, they learn a lot of crucial things about how to exist in a community and how to affect the world. And that was certainly my experience. As I mentioned in the piece, I did all kinds of things. Like, in the 90s, I got an internship with a real game company after I had been on the internet for a while. I was about 15 when I was offered that internship. I also, like, started a blog that ended up getting pretty popular and famous. It was anonymous, so I wouldn't have dared start under my real name because it was about controversial topics. But it got famous, and, you know, I spoke at universities, I traveled, I got book deals. A lot of the work that I do right now is very influenced by the things that I learned while writing those things. And so I don't think it's really possible to disentangle the advantages that I got from anonymity out of the experiences that I could have had otherwise.
We're talking with writer Lydia Lawrenson, who says there's a case to be made for a more anonymous internet. And we want to hear from you on this.
Do you see value in anonymous expression online, or should we have to attach our names to our words and actions whenever and wherever we use them online? And have you tried this? Have you learned some valuable skills in building a community, leadership, maybe from an online gaming community or elsewhere? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with writer, researcher, and media strategist Lydia Lawrenson, who says there's a case to be made for internet users to remain nameless online, despite a recent push for real names on the internet.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Where do you fall on this question? Using an anonymous identity or a pseudonym, do you participate in online conversations, activities that you normally wouldn't? Did that go well or poorly? Do you get to act a little different, do things you might not do otherwise? What should sites do? Require names or not? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Lydia, in your piece, you talk about how when people have their real names, you talk about, you know, the proverbial teenager posting the drinking photo online and it sticks with them forever. Do we need opportunities to misbehave online that won't dog us for the rest of our careers?
I mean, I think people need opportunities to misbehave in general, frankly, that won't dog them for the rest of their careers. I mean, it's a religious metaphor, of course, and I know not everyone is religious, but think about what Jesus said when he said, you know, let he who has never sinned cast the first stone. Like, no one among us has never made a mistake. And of course there are mistakes that deserve to be punished severely, but do those mistakes include things like drinking a beer in college? I mean, really? Like, do we really think that people deserve to lose their jobs in 10 years because there's a picture of them on Facebook with a keg? That just seems crazy to me. And I think that seems crazy to a lot of people, but people are really anxious in this in our employment climate right now, you know, like people are really worried about their jobs. People are really scared about their financial stability. And it's a serious problem that everybody is so afraid, partly because of these environments where they know that their actions could dog them forever across the rest of their lives.
We're going to go to our callers now and talk to Nikhil from Eau Claire. Hi, Nikhil.
Yes, I had a comment and a question. Basically, what I'm curious about is, I know that I've been involved in the internet. I was born in 84, so I was one of the first students to be introduced to the computer class, and I was first to get my email account when emails were available, you know, Yahoo, Gmail, all of the accounts above. And my concern is that no matter where I'm at, whether I'm at a laptop, a hard top, an iPad device, that really there is no being anonymous because it can all be tracked to me. So I'm kind of curious where the concept of being anonymous comes from, because regardless, there are federal entities and other entities out there that can and are willing to track you overall throughout what you do.
All right. And thanks, Nikhil. Some good points there, you know, especially this week as we've seen the hacking of celebrity accounts. Is there really any such thing as anonymous anymore anyway?
I mean, I think it's a good question, of course. Like, and certainly there's always going to be someone who can identify you. If you're commenting on someone else's platform, then at the very least, they probably know who you are. There are a few exceptions. I know that Gawker, the Gawker Media Group, allows some anonymous tips to be sent, where as soon as they get the tips, they then get rid of all of the information that was attached to those tips. So even if, even if they were taken to court, they wouldn't know who left those tips. But that actually takes quite a lot of technical effort and expertise for them to set up, and most places don't do that. So if you are leaving an anonymous comment somewhere, then you should think about who it's anonymous from, right? And in my article, I talk about this because there's a lot of platforms right now where people think it's anonymous and they use it thinking that it's anonymous. Secret is a good example. Secret is an app that advertises itself as a place where people can speak freely, but they can identify you, and they will if they're taken to court. The same goes with Snapchat, right? Like Snapchat just had to settle with the Federal Trade Commission because they were claiming that everything you send on Snapchat definitely disappears. And of course it doesn't, because you can record it in your phone. You can screen cap anything that's sent on Snapchat, even though Snapchat itself deletes the image.
Thanks a lot for the call. So, Nikhil, we'll go to Chris in Madison now. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I want to propose a hypothetical middle ground. Insofar as maybe it's possible that people have a permanent pseudonym, insofar as that if you have it, then people can vote and, you know, whether it's a valuable comment or not. And then there's a certain amount of notoriety or, you know, recognition and seeing your pseudonym, but it's still disassociated from your name and your actual person.
Chris, thanks a lot for the suggestion, Lydia. So a permanent pseudonym, at least within one site where you're a community member and as a member accountable for what you post and say.
Yeah, a lot of sites have programs like that. I mean, you can circumvent them if you're technically savvy, but it's definitely something that people have looked at. And certainly in my experience as a blogger and writer on the internet, I formed a lot of relationships with people where we knew each other under a specific name, you know, like people where we weren't necessarily using that name everywhere on the internet, but it wasn't our real name and we were using it a lot. So like they would recognize me under that name on one website, on another website, on Twitter. And so it wouldn't exactly be a permanent pseudonym in the same way. It wouldn't be enforced, but it was something that I did because I wanted my words to have credibility under this other name. And a lot of people do that, and I think that's totally a reasonable middle ground. If somebody really can't stomach the idea of anonymity, pseudonymity is totally fine. My concern is just that, you know, I don't want to have both of those options thrown out. I don't want to have anonymity thrown out entirely, because even though it doesn't necessarily enforce accountability the same way pseudonymity and real names do, it's still really valuable for these identity reasons and also for political and free speech reasons.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris, for the call. And on to Randy in Sauk County. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi. You know, we're overlooking one possible real benefit to anonymity, having raised a large family and seen other children and so on. there's times where, especially teenagers, in their attempts where they're being pressured for something or whatever, they have no place to turn, and they need to figure something out. The only thing they can do is reach out some anonymous way. A couple of situations, either a young lady being pressured for sex or a young man trying to figure out if he's gay. One, they can't go to their parents, unfortunately, or fortunately, maybe. They don't want a big thing made of it. They can't go to their friends. They need to reach out in some way. If they have this resource of being anonymous, it's my observation, they might be able to sort it out.
Thanks a lot, Randy, for bringing that up. I want to get our guest in on this before we run out of time. This is something you have thought about too, Lydia. How does it help, do you think, people who are in need of help, of reaching out?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's really crucial. It was certainly important for me as a teenager. Like, I went through a lot of bullying in school. I mean, people talk about cyberbullying these days, but frankly, all the worst bullying that I put up with when I was a kid was in person. And I went online to get away from it. And I think that, right, if those people are looking for help and looking for friends and they can't turn to people at school or at home, then the internet's a natural place to go. And they don't want those people to follow them onto the internet. And I think that, again, you can build up an ongoing identity there if you want, or you can be anonymous or whatever. The main thing, again, is to keep in mind that not all of these platforms are actually anonymous, even if they tell you that they are. And the only way that you can really be safe is if you use something like the Tor browser. That's spelled T-O-R. If you search for the Tor browser, Tor is probably the most secure way to communicate in a relatively anonymous way in the modern internet.
Lydia, thank you so much for joining us today. That's Lydia Lawrenson. She's a writer, researcher, and media strategist based in San Francisco. Her piece, A More Pseudonymous Internet, appeared in The Atlantic.